Welcome to Pop the Left. This is part two of our conversation on the revolutions of 1848.
So one of the things that I think is clear from this little quick outline of the history of it is that there was no set, there were lots of revolutions, lots of uprisings, but there was no set of core principles or ideas that were driving everyone to rebel. It was a multiplicity of reasons for the rebellions or the revolutionary actions.
I mean, I like to think of the Frankfurt Wall as a good example of who's on this side. So you have Richard Wagner and Bakunin fighting the Confederated troops of the German states, with Ingalls leading an army, like a battalion of an army nearby. All right. Like, those are who are on the same side. Wagner, the reactionary anti-Semitic German nationalist.
Right.
But at this time is aligned with progressive forces. Bakunin, the anarchist, who is, you know, allied to Republican forces in Italy and Polish nationalist forces. And Ingalls, you know, the bourgeois socialist, you know, and Marx is in the background, although Marx never lives down the fact that he doesn't fight in this. Like it's constantly thrown at him for the rest of his life. And you know, his only cover is Ingalls fought and led a battalion, and he was a general in a battalion. So
right,
like,
I don't blame him. He had writing to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, also he was in really, even that early on, he was in poor health. But like that's one of the things Bakunin and Wagner and everybody throw at him forever, is that he did not fight during the Revolution of 1848. But I mean, he was also getting expelled from Belgium too. I mean, like,
right?
Like, I mean, like, it was like. He was, it was a mess, as you can see. But
how many people at the time in 1848 thought that there was more of a consensus than there was? I mean, or was it?
There was a consensus against, but not for.
Right.
It was one of those things that was clear what everybody was fighting against, not clear what they were fighting for, which is like, for example, when you look at the Spanish Republicans. It was, you know, in the 20th century, because more people know that. Mm-hmm. It's the same problem. You start having internal fighting immediately once you start having any successes at all. And because you're internally fighting and you haven't completely vanquished, you know, the old regime yet, they use your divisions and crush you.
Right.
That happened over and over again. And that division had also happened in the United – I mean, not in the United States as badly, but in the in Latin America – in the Americas, it happened all the time too.
Right, and that's because the development of, let's say, industrial capitalism created a multiplicity of interests within
– right.
Not just between bourgeoisie and worker, but also between urban and rural worker. The old diminishing peasant class and the coming – bourgeois and proletariat class.
Right. And really also between these new identities as these kind of religious identities became less important.
And those new identities would be?
The national identities would replace the old religious ones. Because you got to think, like, prior to this, the primary divider of polities is religion. Now, you know, in the early modern period, this is decided by religious wars. Now you have something new. I mean, partly as a product of production and partly as a product of those religious wars, you have something new emerging as your new identity.
Which is your ethnic identity.
Your ethnic identity. The idea of, you know, because nation and ethnicity used to be like literally when we translate in the Bible, for example, we translate the word for nation and the word for ethnic is both ethnoi.
Right.
Like, it's the same word. Which is also when they talk about nations in 17th and 18th century and early 19th century texts, we're always confused because we always think they're talking about nation states and they're not.
Now, the concept of Europe, was that being put down at this point or was it being?
No, Europe is interesting than older concepts. So Europe emerges as a concept in the late medieval period around the 12th century when Byzantium
okay.
and the end of the Eastern Roman Empire falls to the Turks. So the but you really have the establishment of Europe as an idea by 1492. But you don't have the establishment of like an idea of, say, a racial Europe or whiteness. That all actually comes in the 17th and 18th century. That's later.
Right.
And that's still not everywhere. The only places that really have that clear identity are Portugal, Spain, and England, and to some degree France.
Around this time, I mean, in the 19th
around
century.
This time, around this time period, this racial identity.
But those were also being cut against their national ethnic identities.
Right, they were. And sometimes it leads to like them talking about nations as races, too. You hear stuff about the English race and the German race. But that really is interestingly like a product of early modern, early capitalist colonial and imperialism. So that's not as much in play in 1848.
Right, but what I was asking was, in order for these newly emerging states to take hold of an ethnic identity, do they have to overcome some sort of larger European identity, whether that was cast in? But those were like religious ideas,
right? Those were like religious identities, right?
Right.
So the idea of Christendom being solely European happens with the Eastern Roman Empire falls. And then that's when you start seeing popes and kings using European in letters. And before that, you don't have anything like that. But you still have this lingering idea that we can have like the Roman Empire again, you know, and it, basically until the Holy Roman Empire is crushed, someone's claiming it's to be a successor.
So until the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so now I think we've told a pretty adequate story of 1848. At least we've outlined it. Not really an adequate story, but we've given it in brief. And maybe it's all over the place, but so was 1848. So now to step back and say, how is it that Marx and the socialists felt that this revolution, which was as much about the creation of national identities and the development of the bourgeoisie, also held so much hope for their own socialist struggle?
Because you see the working class emerging as separate from the peasant classes for the first time, like in mass. You had seen that in England, mm-hmm. and you had seen that a little bit in France. But in general, in Europe, outside of England and France, that had not happened yet. That was happening now. And so one of the things that makes it interesting, the national and liberal identities in, say, England, while you had some like proto-communists, but they were mostly religious, like the Diggers and the Levellers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the Luddites. But you don't have the emergence of like working class movements concurrent to national liberal ones. Because you don't have an industrialized working class. The difference between, say, a wage-earning working-class person in agrarian England and like a yeoman who's basically petit bourgeois or proto-petit bourgeois, depending on the time you're talking about, they're not that distinct from one another until the Industrial Revolution really exacerbates the scale in which you can exploit people. And so like the form of capitalism that you get that hits Europe is a little bit nastier, a little bit more advanced, a little bit dirtier than what had emerged in England.
Right.
And what had emerged in maybe the Italian city-states too.
But they saw the working classes that were emerging, not just in urban areas, but the working class, even the agrarian working class, as the class that could make good on the sort of Chartist demands of the early 19th century, the Republican
right.
dream of a democratic
state. They saw that because the working class had no incentive to keep any privileges.
Right.
Like it had nothing to lose but its chains.
Yeah.
And even peasants who could sometimes be in worse off conditions, they still had traditional privileges and like the ownership of some of their own means of production that the proletariat didn't. So like Marx to point out, there have been peasant revolts all the way back through history. But what happens to the peasant revolts? It just changes the successful peasant leaders just become either bourgeois or a minor aristocracy in the current regime, and you might have temporary relief, but the idea of peasant doesn't go away because it really can't. You have to have someone producing the food. And with the proletariat and with wage earning production, you don't have to have a class of people producing. I mean, you do have to have people producing, but what's different is like the entire production system has other elements to it than just like producer protector or producer consumer, which is what the feudal system is, and even the early modern system to some degree. Like the more and more, and you don't just have like in the early modern system, you have producer merchant, you know, you have markets, but you don't really have wage earners really. And like you might have some, but they're a very, very small portion of the entirety of the system. And that's not true by the time Marx had tried it.
And this is why in the 20th century, some people might abandon the working class as a revolutionary subject when a consumerist, like say in the mid 20th century, when a consumerist capitalism arose and workers had, some of them anyway, had homes.
Right.
And television sets.
And stocks.
And stocks.
And thus some investment into the capital itself.
Right. So then they were seen to be having something to lose.
Right.
If they were to institute a classless society.
Exactly. Which is why you start seeing the search for a new revolutionary subject. It's not just that like, oh, the Soviet Union isn't what we want. And, oh, these, you know, advanced capitalist sectors have not done this the way they're supposed to. That's part of it. It is. But another part of it is just like there are different conditions on the ground. You start seeing a bunch of people like in the 50s, this new idea of who the proletariat is. Because Marx does say, like a footnote he excised from the manifesto, he does point out the proletariat's not always the working class. The proletariat is the class without property or advantage. Like it's a category older than working class. It goes back to the Roman Republic.
Right.
But the working class being the proletariat is specific to a time and place. And you and I obviously still think the working class is, or at least most of it is still the proletariat, but we have to really look at why those ideas would have fallen out of favor. And there were reasons that were not irrational.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the question of the proletariat, this is where I'm probably the least Marxist in a way, because there's two aspects of Marx's theory about capitalism where the proletariat or the working class play a vital role. One is as the source of value within capitalism.
Correct.
But the other is this one. As a political force that can obtain a working republic.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And I'm not so sure if I actually hold that anymore or not.
I mean, that seems to be the great question of Marxist politics these days. Is the working class still really, truly?
Well, there's two questions about that. One is, are we still trying to achieve an operable republic? You know?
Right.
Do we even have a vision of a political form that we're trying to achieve? And then the second question is, are these workers the right kind of people to do it?
Right. Well, there's also a third question is, okay, so the are we trying to achieve a republic? Are we trying to achieve a democracy? And they're not the same thing.
Right. No. Right. But I mean, a democratic republic, I think, was the aim of just kind of loosely.
Yeah,
the aim of Marx and the socialist republicans in 1848.
Agreed. Yeah. I think that question actually is more open for Marx by the 1870s. Honestly, when you get to the Brumaire, but I agree with you. In 1848, it's clear he has a kind of democratic republican hybrid model. And even later on, when he like has more, he actually has more. Interestingly, the dictatorship of the proletariat is included in a more radically democratic idea. I mean, one of the reasons why it's the dictatorship of the proletariat, not the dictatorship for the proletariat, is like everyone in the proletariat and all subsidiary classes aligned with it get a vote. But they have removed the political agency of the opposed classes until all classes are abolished.
Right.
Right. So, like, and that's all quite vague, but, like, that's still out of that.
We should do a whole episode just on the concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat and cross-examine it as much as we can.
Yeah, we should.
So we should, but I'm not saying stop talking about it now. But stop talking about it now. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, but it's not. But it's important to point out it's not part of Marx's 1848 visions.
Yeah,
that doesn't come up until the Paris Commune.
Right, and the reason he, just to kind of wrap that part of the, this part of the conversation up, the reason it comes up in after the Paris Commune is because he no longer holds with the idea that the state, as it is now, or as it was conceived of in the 1840s, could be anything but a power for capital.
Right. It is a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie.
Right. And he, what was it about the, you know what it was about the Paris Commune that led him to that conclusion?
They kept on playing by the rules so much and got themselves massacred because they did.
Okay.
Because what happened is they would try to work within rule, like some sort of, even though they were suspending the law in a lot of ways, both Bakunin and Marx basically say they still try to work too much within the current systems to establish legitimacy, and because that self make themselves weak, and because they have a bunch of conflicting class interests amongst their orders, there's divisions among them, and then the bourgeoisie can just come and shoot them all. Which, you know, is what happens.
Right.
So the dictatorship of the proletariat is a kind of temporary suspension of full political agency for people outside of proletarian interests, so that a new state can emerge from proletarian interests. And then everybody, presumably who's not dead, and anybody who throws their lot in with the proletariat even afterwards would be included, because also the proletariat wouldn't be the proletariat anymore.
Right.
It would be abolished. Now, the lonely moment of the abolishment of the proletariat has so far never happened, but, you know, that's the idea.
So just to return to this question of whether the proletariat could be that the radical subject, we've noted that it's tied to this conception of the aim of revolution being a kind of republicanism at that time. And the need for the dictatorship of the proletariat, does that change, you think, the kind of subjects that's needed?
That's a good question. I mean, one of the things about the dictatorship of the proletariat is that it assumes that not only can every cook govern, that they can already govern.
Right.
So that's – which is – I mean, I know that's a weird distinction, but it is one. And the other thing is, like, Marx doesn't answer – like, Marx is really – in, like, his economic manuscripts, for example, he talks about the coming of what he sees communism. And, like, by the 1860s, he admits that his vision could happen either democratically or not. Like, the form is important, but it isn't the economic relations could change by other means. And I don't think that means he would, like, the dictatorship of the proletariat. When we think about dictatorships, we have this modern vision of what it is.
Right.
But we have to remember that a dictatorship in the Roman Republican form is a temporary thing in a republic itself. That is, to save the republic, you suspend the rules of sovereignty.
Right. Yeah, we should definitely do a whole episode on the dictatorship of the proletariat. But just to stick with this 1848 moment, because I feel like some of the things that happened there are still repeating, or some of the problems there are still within the struggle for socialism are still thought of.
Thank you for listening to Pop the Left. We'd like to thank our producer, Toby Keemer, and everyone at Zero Books for supporting the podcast. Please contribute to the Zero Books Patreon to keep us going and to hear additional episodes. This is Pop-